It is Friday, November the 2nd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, President Trump's thoughts on a caravan of migrants making their way to the U.S. border with Mexico.
They should turn back now because they're wasting their time. They should apply to come into our country. We want them to come into our country.
Two Muslim women poised to become U.S. members of Congress.
The fact that these two women are being elected in this election cycle, which is a cycle very much about change, I think it's entirely, you know, it's just a reflection of the times we live in.
Also ahead, worldwide protests by Google workers, plus the sounds of Dan Fogelberg. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Thousands of Central American migrants have resumed their slow trek through southern Mexico. A second, smaller caravan trails about 320 kilometers behind. Meantime, President Trump spoke about all of this at the White House.
I'd like to provide an update to the American people regarding the crisis on our southern border, and crisis it is. Illegal immigration affects the lives of all Americans. Illegal immigration hurts American workers, burdens American taxpayers, and undermines public safety, and places enormous strain on our local schools, hospitals, and communities in general, taking precious resources away from the poorest Americans who need them most. Illegal immigration costs our country billions and billions of dollars each year. America is a welcoming country, and under my leadership, it's a welcoming country. We lead the world in humanitarian protection and assistance by far. It's nobody even close. We have the largest and most expansive immigration programs anywhere on the planet. We've issued 40 million green cards since 1970, which means the permanent residency and a path to citizenship for many, many people. But we will not allow our generosity to be abused by those who would break our laws, defy our rules, violate our borders, break into our country illegally. We won't allow it. Mass uncontrolled immigration is especially unfair to the many wonderful law-abiding immigrants already living here who followed the rules and waited their turn. Some have been waiting for many years. Some have been waiting for a long time. They've done everything perfectly. And they're going to come in. At some point, they're going to come in. In many cases, very soon. We need them to come in. Because we have companies coming into our country, they need workers, but they have to come in on a merit basis, and they will come in on a merit basis. The communities are often left to bear the cost and the influx of people that come in illegally. We can't allow that. There's a limit to how many people a nation can responsibly absorb into their societies. Every day, above and beyond our existing lawful admission programs, roughly 1,500 to 2,000 people try crossing our borders illegally. We do a very good job considering the laws are so bad. They're not archaic. They're incompetent. It's not that they're old. They're just bad. And we can't get any Democrat votes to change them. It's only the Republicans that are in unison. They want to change them. They want to make strong borders, want to get rid of any crime because of the borders, of which there's a lot. And we've done a great job with the laws that we have.
The migrants are still more than 1,000 kilometers from the United States, but President Trump has called them invaders and says he might send as many as 15,000 troops to counter what he views as a threat to the U.S. Also in the news, two Muslim women are poised to become the first to enter the U.S. Congress following the November 6th election, both having served in their respective state legislatures, 42-year-old Palestinian-American Rashida Tlaib of Michigan and 36-year-old Somali-American-born Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. Both are Democrats. Tlaib has no Republican opposition, while Ilhan hopes to represent a district that usually votes Democrat. They would be the third and fourth Muslims to serve in the U.S. Congress after Indiana's Congressman Andre Carson and Minnesota's Keith Ellison, who was the first Muslim congressman back in 2006. He is leaving his post to contest for the state's Office of Attorney General. Sally Howell is the director of the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn. She spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about the significance of the expected election victories for the two Muslim women.
The fact that these two women are being elected in this election cycle, which is a cycle very much about change, I think it's entirely, you know, it's just a reflection of the times we live in. I think both women were politically active long before Donald Trump rose to the national stage. They were active at the local level. They were both state representatives for their districts, people who had long careers of providing service in at the neighborhood community level and did a good job of representing their districts at the state level. And therefore, when the seats opened up, you know, they were, you know, very attractive candidates, and clearly they won, you know, in their primaries. Both are heavily Democratic districts, and so Rashida is actually running unopposed, and Ilhan's, you know, district is so heavily Democratic that it looks like she's a shoo-in for that vote as well.
Rashida was born in Detroit, but she has Palestinian immigrant parents, and apparently she has a lot of people in the West Bank rooting for her.
She's from the Beit Hanina community, and that's a large population here in the Detroit area. Her father is from that community. You know, it's one of the bigger Palestinian communities that's been in Detroit for, you know, really since the 1960s. Her father was an auto worker, raised a very large family, lots of children. I believe there are 12 children. She still lives in the city. She's raising her children there. She knows the city very well. She's been a sort of political activist there and grassroots organizer there for the last 25 years.
As for Ilhan Omar, she was born in Somalia. She's described as a hijab-wearing Minnesota state lawmaker. What can you tell me about her?
She's similar to Rashida in that her platform is a very progressive platform. Again, you know, she wants Medicare for all, free college tuition for students. She also represents a district that has a lot of low-income people in it, but it also has a large university population. So, you know, she sort of embraces the issues of that community. And she's, you know, been a leader in the Somali community. Yes, she is herself an immigrant. She's married to an immigrant. She's raising a family of, you know, American-born children. And, you know, she represents the needs and the political interests of her constituents.
Sally Howell also told VOA's Victor Beatty the two women not only have extensive contacts in Somalia and the Palestinian territories, but also with the Palestinian and Somali diaspora and are illustrative of the changing face of American politics. The U.S. government says that the number of homeless veterans has decreased across the country, but the problem has not been solved yet. That story now from AP's Jackie Quinn.
There are 38,000 homeless veterans in the U.S., and while that may sound high, it's half as many as were homeless in the year 2010. Officials say a federal initiative funded about a decade ago has helped, providing permanent housing while also offering veterans a case manager and clinical care, unlike before when they had to be in treatment for mental health issues before they could qualify for housing. Last year, there was a small increase in homeless vets due largely to the higher cost of housing in the Los Angeles area, which is now the focus of the Veterans Affairs Department. I'm Jackie Quinn.
And still ahead on International Edition, tens of thousands of Africans in limbo in Israel. This is VOA.
A recent report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change paints a rather gloomy picture of the future of planet Earth. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo. Please join Peter Frumhoff from the Union of Concerned Scientists and me for the Science Edition of Press Conference USA when we discuss the report and its possible implications. Listen for it this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Israel has stopped its policy of forced deportation of African asylum seekers, but it has not granted the vast majority of them refugee status, leaving more than 40,000 people simply in limbo. Linda Gradstein reporting now from Tel Aviv.
Michael Aforke from Eritrea remembers his first week in Israel. He had no money and slept in a Tel Aviv park. 8 years later, speaking fluent Hebrew and with two children born in Israel, this is still not home.
I'm not considered a resident, not considered anything. Like, I'm in the air. I live from hand to mouth, not knowing what will happen tomorrow. My children and I have no status.
Israelis work with asylum seekers at the African Refugee Development Center in Tel Aviv and see how the uncertainty is creating stress in the community. Some refugees do not want their face on camera.
What is our status? Are we staying here? Are we going back? Where is the life it will take us? Because we need to know.
40,000 asylum seekers have special visas that allow them to work in Israel. The Israeli Supreme Court ruled the state must give their children free education, but they do not receive health care or any other benefits. The Workers' Hotline, a rights group, advises asylum seekers about a new Israeli law, which requires their employers to deposit 20% of their salary in a special fund, returned only when they leave Israel.
They feel the burden of the deposit law. They're running out of air. There's no more saving. There's nothing.
Some asylum seekers complain their employers have deducted money from their salaries, but there's no record of that money being deposited anywhere.
I want my money back. It's my money that they took out of my salary every month. It's thousands of dollars and they stole it from me.
Thinking about what this means for her young son is too much to bear.
I am a refugee and I don't want him to go through what I did. I want him to have a country that he belongs to and where he can realize his dreams.
Lola would like to return one day to Eritrea, but she doesn't know when or if that will happen. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Tel Aviv.
Hundreds of thousands of Google employees, most of them women, walked off the job at nearly two dozen company offices around the world, protesting the company's handling of sexual harassment cases. They also protested against its workplace culture. The walkouts are the latest indications of employee dissatisfaction that escalated last week after the New York Times newspaper reported that the internet giant paid millions of dollars in severance pay to male executives accused of harassment without disclosing their inappropriate conduct. Michelle Quinn is VOA's Silicon Valley bureau chief, and she speaks here from San Francisco with VOA's Sarah Williams.
The spotlight's been on Google for a long time about the number of women working there versus the number of men. I think the latest thing I saw was that maybe 30% of the workforce is women. And then if you look at technical roles, there's even fewer women. And if you look at management, it's pretty slim, too. So this has been an ongoing issue. And I have to say Google's been working on it for a while. But a series of disclosures about sexual harassment, and particularly payouts to male and superstar employees when they were found to have credible evidence of sexual harassment, has really sparked this protest that's going around the world. It sounds like everybody in each time zone is leaving their office if they support this protest at 11:10. So it's creating this sort of, Google is, more than 50,000 employees around the world, so it's creating this sort of around the globe experience.
And this protest is basically, is it like a short walk-off?
That's right. My understanding is that it's a short walk-off. People speak, and then they go back to work. But it's still pretty striking. If you could think about, this is a non-union or industry where there's not an organized way for employees to speak. What happened was that people created this group inside Google, and it's called Google Walkout for Real Change. The people created the group and organized just using internal Google messaging and then also Twitter. So in an industry that doesn't have a union, the fact that employees are coming out is really, really interesting.
Well, apparently one of the cases that got a number of Google employees upset was involved the former senior vice president, Andy Rubin, who apparently was paid $90 million when he left the company.
Yeah, I mean, Andy Rubin is a legend in Silicon Valley. He worked at Apple. He was at this company. And he's been this person who's had these ideas about mobile operating system. So he's been with Google, and he's really been the kind of push for Android, which is Google's mobile operating system. And he, you know, allegedly was accused of sexual misconduct and allegedly was paid $90 million in severance, even after there was a, what the Google has termed a credible finding of sexual misconduct. So, I mean, he is a superstar. I don't know if he would have been paid $90 million if this allegation hadn't surfaced, but the fact that people here are saying this is not okay, this is, we can't treat our superstars like they walk on water. They need, there needs to be consequences. I think that that's what today's about. And then I was looking at the people organizing the walkout have really, have kind of created their like 5 points of what they want to change. And one of them is to basically make a public disclosure of sexual harassment every, maybe every year. And it's, you know, Google's already sort of famous for, it has a, puts out a transparency report every 6 months saying, you know, which government asked it to take down links, the number of times law enforcement has contacted them. But this is something that the employees are asking for. We want you to report publicly about sexual harassment. And that's pretty interesting.
VOA Silicon Valley Bureau Chief Michelle Quinn reporting from San Francisco, and she was speaking with my colleague Sarah Williams. Saying Chinese economic espionage poses a grave threat to U.S. national interest, Attorney General Jeff Sessions has announced a new Justice Department initiative to combat China's rampant theft of American intellectual property.
Chinese economic espionage against the United States has been increasing, and it has been increasing rapidly. We are here today to say enough is enough.
Sessions said the new Chinese initiative will identify priority Chinese trade theft cases, ensure that enough resources are dedicated to them, and to make sure an appropriate conclusion quickly and effectively happens. Sessions said a federal grand jury looking into the theft of trade has returned an indictment.
Alleging economic espionage on the part of a Chinese state-owned, government-owned company, a Taiwan company, and three Taiwan individuals for an alleged scheme to steal trade secrets from Micron, an Idaho-based semiconductor company.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions' announcement came amid an escalating trade war between the U.S. And China has dismissed the charges of economic espionage. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Each of Earth's living beings has a built-in biological clock that functions over a 24-hour cycle. The so-called circadian clock is a well-regulated biological process which helps keep our bodies healthy by regulating tasks such as sleeping, waking, body temperature, and other important functions. Now a group of scientists at Chicago's Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine have developed what they call the first simple blood test that will tell what time it is according to your body's internal clock. Called Time Signature, the test will provide researchers new insight into the impact of unsynchronized internal clocks on a wide range of diseases. One day, this test could become an important part of personalized medicine, helping your doctor determine when you should be taking your medications and other important health decisions. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Time now for a little something from the world of music. Dan Fogelberg was an American musician, songwriter, composer, and multi-instrumentalist. He was best known for his hits of the 1980s, including Longer.
Deeper than any forest primeval, I am in love with you. I'll bring fire in the winters, you'll send showers in the springs. We'll fly through the falls and summers with love. Through the years, as the fire starts to mellow, burning lines in the book of our lives, though the binding cracks and the pages start to yellow, I'll be in love with you.
I'll be in 1972, Fogelberg released his debut album, Home Free, to lukewarm response, although it eventually reached platinum status, and he performed as an opening act for singer-songwriter Van Morrison. And in 1974, Joe Walsh produced his album Souvenirs, after which Fogelberg released a string of gold and platinum albums. One of those was The Innocent Age, released in 1981, becoming Dan Fogelberg's critical and commercial peak. The double album included a number of his biggest hits, such as Hard to Say. Fogelberg, the youngest of three sons, was born in Peoria, Illinois in 1951. His mother was a classically trained pianist and his father a high school band director. Fogelberg's mother was a Scottish immigrant and his father was of Swedish descent. He also would later be the inspiration for Fogelberg's super hit, Leader of the Band.
Earned his love through discipline, a thundering
at hand. His gentle means of sculpting souls took me years to understand. The leader of the band is tired and his eyes are growing old, but his blood runs through my instrument and his song is in my soul. My life has been a poor attempt to imitate the man. I'm just a living legacy to the leader of the band.
Dan Fogelberg was married three times. He had no children by any of those marriages. In May of 2004, he was diagnosed with advanced prostate cancer. After undergoing therapy, his cancer went into partial remission. But in December 2007, after the cancer returned, Dan Fogelberg died at his home in the state of Maine. He was 56.
Living out this life I've chose and come to know so well.
Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you here. The latest world news is straight ahead, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We're all hoping you have a super Friday. Now a bit more from Dan Fogelberg.
And Papa, I don't think I said I love you near enough. The leader of the band is tired and his eyes are growing old, but his blood runs through my instrument and his song is in my soul. My life has been a poor attempt to imitate the man. I'm just a living legacy to the leader of the band. I am a living legacy to the leader of the band. This
is Today in History.
In 644, Umar ibn al-Khattab, the second Muslim caliph, was killed by a Persian captive in Medina. Umar, who is regarded as the architect of the Islamic Empire, had taken over a large part of Persia. He is considered one of the most influential figures in Islamic history. In 1534, the English Parliament passed the Act of Supremacy, making King Henry VIII head of the Church of England, thus removing the official church in England from the realm of Roman Catholicism. Henry had sought the separation after the Pope refused to grant him a divorce. On this date in 1903, Panama declared its independence from Colombia. A treaty was quickly signed granting the United States possession of the Panama Canal Zone, a waterway connecting the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. The canal opened in 1914. In 1911, one of the world's most recognized brands of American automobiles entered the market to compete with the Ford Model T. Co-founded by Louis Chevrolet and William C. Durant, Chevrolet unveiled the Classic 6 touring sedan. In 1957, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik 2, the second spacecraft launched into Earth orbit, and the first to carry a living animal, a dog named Laika. Also on this day in 1957, the song At the Hop was released by a rock group known as Danny and the Juniors. The Hop went to number one thanks in part to the group's appearance on American Bandstand, a national TV show featuring pop music and dancing. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.